This podcast is brought to you by the Vancouver Sun.
You're listening to an episode of Unedited with Vancouver Sun Arts and Entertainment editor and reporter Francois Marchand.
Mike Fraser is a veteran Vancouver sound producer and engineer who's worked with a number of high-profile rock bands over the years. One of these bands is a certain group called AC/DC, and they're coming to Vancouver at BC Place on September 22nd. So, in advance of the show, we had a little conversation with Mike Fraser about some of the highlights in his career working with AC/DC and some of his favorite moments and his relationship with the Australian band. Mike Fraser, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great today. How are you doing?
Very good. What are you up to?
I've just got back from a couple weeks in my cabin, which is up outside of 100 Mile House. So I'm just back home here now and relaxing in our fine Vancouver sunshine.
So you're not working on anything yet? You're not mixing or engineering anything at the moment?
Not today. I try and take it a little easier in the summertime when I can. So, just enjoying myself.
Cool. For people that don't know you, and if they don't, really, shame on them, why don't you give us a quick little intro of who you are, Mike Fraser?
I'm a producer, engineer, and mixer. I do record and mix records. I've been doing it for about 35 years now in Vancouver here. Started out at Little Mountain Sound, and when Little Mountain disappeared, work now in more of the Armory and the Warehouse studio. So, you know, always trying to bring all the work stuff back here and managed to, over the 35 years, work with a lot of pretty cool bands.
Yeah, let's talk about
AC/DC being one of them.
Exactly.
They're in town soon.
That's what I was going to say. Let's talk about that tiny little band, AC/DC, those upstarts from Australia. Tell me about how you ended up meeting those guys, because you've worked on 5 of their studio albums and you've mixed and engineered some of their live stuff too.
Yep.
Some massive songs have come out of those sessions, but let's time travel. Let's hop into the DeLorean and go back to your first encounter with AC/DC.
Jeez. Well, that'll be back in the 90s on Razor's Edge was the first album I worked with them on. They had been, I believe they recorded that record in Ireland, and they were most of the way done. They just had vocals and some guitar solos to do, and their brother George Young was producing it. And I believe he got sick, or there was some family emergency, and he couldn't finish the record. So the band looked up Bruce Fairburn and wanted to work with Bruce. So they came to Vancouver, and away we went. We started doing vocals with Brian, and I think one of the first songs we did, he was having a trouble hitting some of the high notes. So what they did is they decided to change the key of the song. So that involved re-recording the guitars and bass again to a different key. And the guys liked the sound of those so much better, we ended up redoing all the basic guitars for the whole record.
Wow.
And so I guess from that point on, they decided that I was going to be their guy in the studio. So
yeah, what was the
great
song
honor?
Yeah, no doubt. What was the song that you had to tweak down? Do you remember?
I forget which the first one was, but you know, then we decided to do the rest. So yeah.
So
in the 90s, that was a long time ago.
Fair enough. 25 years ago or something.
So shut up.
I'll be quiet. Obviously, you've had like amazing moments with the band. When did you know, like, did you know from the first sessions on that this was going to be a long-term relationship?
No, not from that first session. you know, we definitely got along great, and I was quite flattered. They're really excited and impressed with the sounds we got for them on that record, because you know, I've been a huge AC/DC fan from the beginning. So, you know, even to be in the same room with them was such a great experience. But you know, we've really bonded a strong friendship over the years, and you know, I'm, I guess, part of their family now, and you know, it's been pretty awesome.
Yeah.
So then when I got the call to do the next record, which I believe was
Ballbreaker?
Not Ballbreaker, that's it.
Yeah.
So then I thought, oh great, wow, they want me back, and that was with a different producer, with Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's kind of great, they wanted me back in there. And so each time they do a new record and I get the call, I go, oh, wow, hey, that's great.
That's good. You said you were a longtime fan of AC/DC. Obviously,
yep.
The band's been around since 73. They have a long, yep. long history even before you got involved. But your first encounter with AC/DC as a recorded product, and what how that kind of maybe changed the way you you enjoyed rock and roll, I don't know.
Well, it was funny. You know, I was growing up and, you know, in my early teens there, I was, you know, Black Sabbath and really liked Aerosmith.
Yeah.
And went to the Aerosmith concert, P&E, and a band called AC/DC were opening up for them. And I, you know, didn't know much about them. I think it was 15 or 16 or something. I can't remember exactly. So we went there and saw the opening band and we're like just blown away. And we thought, oh, this is going to be great. You know, Aerosmith's going to kick butt and all that. And Aerosmith came on and they were absolutely terrible. That was probably right at their toxic moments.
Yeah.
Because they kept stumbling off the stage and going into the back wings of the stage and I guess, you know, drugging up or whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
And it was a really bad concert and I think we left halfway through, but thought, I got to check out this AC/DC band. So did some searching around and went back and got the record. So just sort of figuring it out now, that was probably the Highway to Hell tour.
Yeah.
And so I've actually seen Bon Scott live, but I didn't realize it at the time. So it was crazy.
You know, you mentioned Aerosmith, who you ended up working yep. with as well, right?
Yeah.
In better days, I would assume. But yeah, so there was a connection.
Well, we started with Permanent Vacation, so that was their first record.
Yeah.
They did sober. And I think they're about 6 weeks sober at that point. So when they came in the studio, they were like little kids in a candy store. They were just so excited to be doing music. And Steven yeah. said that, he says, this is the first time I can actually remember doing a record. He says, previous records, you know, he says, we'd be so out of it. You know, they'd put all these pillows on the floor and lie me down, put a set of headphones on me, and then position a mic in front of me and say, do you hear music? Sing. If you don't hear anything, don't sing.
Jeez. That's a good way of working in the studio.
Oh, man.
Jeez. Rock or Bust is the latest one you've worked on as far as studio albums
yep.
are concerned for AC/DC. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about approaching that album. Was there a different approach there? When I listen to it, I feel like maybe there's the speed's a little slower. Maybe there's a mm-hmm. little bit of an adjustment. Obviously, age is a factor here with a band like AC/DC, but you want to keep that kind of live energy. So tell me about yep. approaching Rock or Bust in its original demo phase and kind of moving into the studio with those tracks.
Well, with AC/DC, with all the records I've done with them, they're just such an amazing band. And if you've ever seen them live or when you go to the show later on in September, you'll see
yeah.
what I mean. It's an amazing band. So when we're in the studio, the approach never really changes. We set them up, get them comfortable, and then they just play amazingly. And, you know, they can usually get a song done in about four or five takes, you know, and
yeah.
Which is really fast for any band. The difference with Rock or Bust was obviously the missing Malcolm. You know, Malcolm's a very big part of that band, and him and Angus have always been sort of the team guys. They bounce off each other and you know, comfort each other or you know, work out any issues they have with, you know, the song or the song tempo. So,
right.
you know, it was kind of bittersweet. I know when we had finished Black Ice, we all kind of thought that's probably going to be the last one, you know, because at that time Malcolm was starting to get sick. And So we didn't think there'd be another record. But, you know, I got to say, I'm really proud of Angus for shouldering the whole load on his shoulders and deciding to do another record. And partially, you know, I would think in tribute to his brother.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a bit... It was, you know, Malcolm was definitely missed in the studio, but, you know, Stevie, his cousin or his nephew, really stepped up to the plate. You know, he played through all Mal's amps and with his guitar and everything so we could retain that AC/DC sound, and I think it worked out really well.
Yeah. Phil Rudd has been another big element in this story. I mean, he was missing in action for, what, 10 days or something? And you know, Brendan O'Brien, who was the producer on this album, I think it had almost made the call of going ahead with either playing it himself or getting someone else to play drums at that point. But Phil showed up, and we know he's been going through some legal battles in New Zealand. What's your take on that?
Well, that was sort of the first surprise or the shock. You know, we all showed up at the studio and no Phil. And I think it was a week or 10 days, he finally showed up. So it turned out okay because, you know, Angus just kind of showed up with song demos and all that. So, you know, him and Brendan and the other band guy kind of sat around and worked out what we were going to do in the studio.
Uh-huh.
So Phil showed up and he set his drums and, you know, he played really well. You know, he's Phil, but he wasn't the same guy I know. So, you know, I don't know what kind of demons are on his back right now. And, you know, I just wish him all the best and then hope he sorts it out for himself. You know?
We mentioned some names for producers. Bruce, obviously, is a big name in your career. Mm-hmm. You mentioned Rick Rubin. He's a pillar of studio work. And Brendan O'Brien, who's a little bit of more of a recent guy working with Pearl Jam and bands like Mastodon and so on. You know, these guys understand AC/DC in their own way, and you understand AC/DC in your own way. How do you make sure it remains an AC/DC album when you're working with different people along the way? Because they all have their own voice, right? So
Well, that's fairly easy. I know when Brendan and I first worked together on Black Ice, you know, we had a bit of a long conversation because, you know, Brendan's a great engineer in his own right. You know, he's not just a producer. So, you know, we talked about how that was going to work, and we both didn't step on each other's toes. And you know, after about a week or so, we became very comfortable with each other. And I guess his trust in me increased as well because, you know, I kind of know what the band are looking for. And I think that's where the band want me there as that go-between. So, you know, I let Brendan do his production thing, and he kind of lets me do work on the sounds and make the band happy and make everything kick ass. And it just ends up working. So I find that, you know, with the other producers that I've worked with Bruce and Rick, even did a record with George Young, you know, mm-hmm. their older brother.
Yep.
And that's just sort of always been my role, you know, make it as easy for them to just concentrate on the production. I've got the rest of it handled, you know.
Yeah. And for people who might not necessarily understand what the differences between a producer, an engineer, and a mixer, in your case, you mm-hmm. said you're the go-between, you know, between the band and the producer. In this case, because AC/DC's had such a long relationship with you, obviously that makes sense. But, you know, to mix an AC/DC album, what does that mean?
Well, that's basically, you know, once we've recorded everything, all the little instruments and bits and pieces are on separate channels.
Yep.
You know, so there'll be a kick drum, snare drum, guitars, bass, and all that. So when you're mixing, you blend all that in together to end up with your stereo file that everybody, you know, gets on their iPad or iTunes or whatever.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, so that's the finished product. So that's the mixing, and that's the final stage. So once everything's been recorded and performed the way we all want it, I'm the one that sort of puts it all together in one package.
Well, you mentioned something. You said iTunes, which I wanted to bring up at some point. You helped remaster all of AC/DC's catalog for iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
And what does that entail? Because obviously when you're working in the 90s, you're mixing for CDs. When you're mm-hmm. working in, you know, the 2000s or 2010s or whatever, you're mixing for digital, streaming, iTunes, and so on. So maybe we can talk about mm-hmm. the difference that it makes on the delivery level for a band like AC/DC. What does that mean to remix it for iTunes? Do you have to bump up certain things or change certain things around, or do you, how do you retain the original feel?
Yeah, well, like with AC/DC, you know, and the probably one of the last bands, you know, not many bands record analog, which is, you know, on a tape machine, but with AC/DC, all their records we've done on tape, 2-inch tape, and we mix it to half-inch tape. So to me, that is the ultimate quality level is on tape. It just sounds amazing, especially for rock music anyways. So, you know, in the 80s, you know, we mix it to do everything and mix it to tape. Then when we master it, we have to adjust adjust the EQ and the levels of the thing so that it'll sound the best it can on CD. Mm-hmm. Now it's the same with iTunes and MP3s. You have to readjust your sounds to make it sound the best it can, because it's each one of these formats, in my opinion, drops down in quality level, you know?
So right.
You have to, you know, fit what you've done down to that quality level. You know, if you could sit there and listen to the same song simultaneously on, say, vinyl, CD, and MP3, you wouldn't believe the difference in sound.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you've gotten the actual experience, because you've heard those songs being created mm-hmm. live, mm-hmm. which is probably the most direct way to experience them. It's just straight to your ear, no filter. So you do see a difference between all those formats. What's mm-hmm. your take on things like Tidal or Neil Young with the Pono? Is that something that's a valid argument to say, look, this is worth the extra money. This is worth the extra spending to get a higher quality on digital format.
Well, yes and no. Like, you know, with Neil Young's thing, I think that was a great idea. I think he's on the right track. But now everybody has to go rebuy their catalog again, or buy a new player thing, and mm-hmm. and it's just asking the consumers to spend yet again. So already for a lot of stuff, they've bought the vinyl. Now they've had to rebuy everything for CD. Oh, now it's out on MP3. Now they've got to rebuy it again. So people are getting sick of rebuying music, you know?
It's true.
So I think it's a good step in the right direction, but it's a big mountain to climb. As how do we do this without, you know, having the consumer feel like they're being ripped off every time they turn around? Like, okay, now they get involved with this. Well, what's coming out 5 years down the road? Is it something else that you have to buy?
And yeah.
That's what gets tiring, you know?
Yeah. Let's talk about some highlights of the AC/DC catalog. Obviously, we're going to hear some mega classics at the show at BC Place, and that should be a whole lot of fun. Some of them you've recorded yourself with them, mm-hmm. or mixed or engineered or both. Let's start with a couple of songs. Thunderstruck.
Funny, you know, looking back on that when we recorded that, as we were recording it, you know, we knew it was going to be a great song, but we had no idea it was going to become one of their classic songs, you know, up there with, you know, Hell's Bells or Back in Black or Higher to Hell or something. You know, it's one of their meat and potato songs, and it's really neat that it's done that, you know. I remember when we were recording that, and we had the song mostly re-recorded. We redid the guitars and that. And Angus says, Bruce said, we need a little intro guitar for this thing. And Angus says, oh, he says, I got a little something I can play. So he started with the dee 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 dee, right? Started that. So that was only supposed to be in the intro of the song. So we put it, record, and we're recording them. And Angus had just lit a cigarette. He sat on a stool with his guitar and started playing. And as we got into the verse of the song, he's still playing his part. So Bruce and I looked at each other and said, oh, well, we'll just keep it rolling. So he played it all the way through the whole song, one take, and at the end of the song, his ass was right down to his filter of his cigarette, and he goes, ah, how was that? Dang, that was great. And if you listen today, it's in the whole song. We just sort of duck it down in the mix in places, but we've left it in through the whole song. But originally, that was supposed to be just the intro.
That's crazy. He played the whole thing through. I like Money Talks a lot, and that's obviously also from Razor's Edge. How about that track in particular?
Come on, Well, that track was a track we had Chris Slade come out on that record and record two more songs. So Money Talks, and I think it was Mr. Christmas was, we recorded everything on that one, bass, drums, and guitars. All the rest of the record, it was just the bass and the guitars that we had redone. But yeah, Money Talks, yeah, I really like that one too. It was great, and it was great to have been able to record with Chris, and it'd be great to see him back out and playing live again. I haven't seen him probably since we did that record, so it's going to be a good time.
Exactly, because I was going to mention that. Chris is playing on September 22nd at BC Place. He's on tour with the band right now, filling in for Phil. So he's not an unknown quantity. People know that he can play with AC/DC, and he's going to deliver.
So that's exactly. And I think, you know, when Chris was replaced with Phil, I think it was only because of Phil's being, you know, one of the original drummers, and it wasn't because of Chris's ability. You know, they didn't replace him because of his ability. I think it was more, hey, it's Phil Rudd, you know?
I feel like if we talk about Ball Breaker, for example, in 95, I feel like Ball Breaker doesn't get as much attention as other AC/DC releases, probably because it came right at the tail end of the whole grunge explosion thing. What's your take on that album? And maybe you can pick one song from that record that's really just a good example of what AC/DC could do still, you know, within the explosion of alt rock and grunge.
Yeah. Well, AC/DC have always been a band that they do the music, you know, for themselves. They don't try and chase any kind of trend or whatever. So when they're doing a record, they want to please themselves first, and then if the fans are happy with it, oh great! So then that's a bonus. But they're not trying to chase a trend. So I do agree. I think that was a great record, but maybe didn't quite have the explosion it could have because of the grunge thing, and everybody's their ears are tuned to more of that kind of music, but. You know, that's what makes AC/DC so great. They've just, through the ages, you know, they've just done their thing. And they such a shining light, everybody gets attracted to it. You know, you go to their shows now and, you know, see the old guys, 80-plus years old there, right down to, you know, 2-3-year-old kids. So it goes across all the genres and all ages, and I think it's brilliant.
What do you think is the standout moment on that album? Or maybe the standout moment for you in working on that record?
Well, I think for me, you know, one, being in the room and actually working on an AC/DC record was blew me away on that record. But, you know, the standout song for me was definitely Thunderstruck, you know. And you just keep hearing it over and over again, whether it's, you know, in the football stadiums or whatever. And it's just such a thrill each time you hear it and just remember that sitting in the studio with them and hearing that power come off the floor as they're playing it. It's just amazing.
That's on Razor's Edge, though. I meant on Ball Breaker. If you had a standout moment on Ball Breaker, because I don't know that album as well. I'll admit it. That's one album that kind of flew under the radar for me. So if I want to hear it from the mixer's mouth, what, you know, if I'm going back to Ball Breaker, what am I listening to first?
Well, that, you know, Ball Breaker was kind of a bit of a different record. Work on just because we had started out in New York and I couldn't start the first couple of days of the session, so Rick Rubin went in there with a guy and they picked a studio in New York called the Power Station, which is a very live room, very sort of roomy and echoey kind of sounding room, and they were just having a problem. So finally, I think it was Angus called me up and said, Mikey, he says, you got to get out here, like, you know, nothing's working. So I went out there and what they were trying to achieve with that record was a very dry, in-your-face kind of record and not so big and roomy like the 80s.
Yeah.
And they had, I guess the management had prepaid the studio bill up front, so we couldn't get out. So we had to sit there for 6 weeks and try and make it happen, and we just couldn't get the sound that we were looking for. So after 6 weeks, we pulled up all our anchors and moved back to L.A., and had to redo the record there. So it was a very long record and really tiring on all of us. But I think we ended up with some really good stuff. You know, I really liked Cover You in Oil and Hard as a Rock.
Yeah.
It was really, really great. Ball Breaker was really awesome too. So there's some really great songs in that. But again, you know, I guess that was your first question. Yeah, this record didn't really do what it could have done because of the tail end of other music that had been out there.
Stiff Upper Lipped, quick memory of that album. 2000, it's a strange turn of the millennium thing going on there. And Stiff Upper Lipped's a little bit more of a, I don't like to call it classic, but maybe a straight up AC/DC thing.
Yeah, well, they they pulled their brother George out of retirement.
Yeah.
George is fully retired, and they convinced him to come out to Vancouver and do record. And on that record, the boys wanted to do a really kind of bluesy kind of record, which is, you know, they've always sort of been blues based-ish, but this is even more so. So that's what they were going for that record. I really enjoyed it, but, you know, I don't know if that record was really such their biggest, you know, kind of release thing either, but, you know, that had some great tunes on it.
Yeah. Black Ice, I guess 2008. Black Ice, Rock and Roll Train. Love that track, and it was it was the standout in concert because you had the train kind of barreling through the stage kind of thing. It kind of kicked things off. I feel Black Ice kind of like a comeback album for some reason. Maybe because it had been 8 years since the previous one. So what about this one? How did you approach Black Ice as a return to AC/DC 8 years after Stiff Upper Lip?
Well, this was the first record that they had, Brendan O'Brien come in. So, you know, I think it took a little bit for the band and him to gel just because this band is so tight-knit. You know, they like family around them and they like familiar things. And Brendan was sort of the... You know, in the first couple of days anyways, kind of, I guess he felt like he was the outside guy and all that.
Yeah.
But I really think Brendan managed to breathe some fresh air into these guys and push them a little bit more to be themselves again, going back to, you know, working with Rick Rubin and that whole record was a bit of a struggle.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Stiff Upper Lip, they said, well, hey, let's try this bluesy thing, which they loved, but, you know, it wasn't that great. So, okay, now what do we do?
Mm-hmm.
So I think Brendan really, you know, like I said, breathed some light into that.
We talked about Rock or Bust already, and I feel like there's, you know, there's a follow-up on Black Ice in there. It sounds like there's a little bit more blues too, but it feels like it's got the AC/DC rock and roll vibe into it. So I'm going to jump right to probably what is one of my favorite music DVDs of all time, which is AC/DC Live at River Plate. And was it Argentina or Brazil? I always get it wrong.
Yeah, Buenos Aires.
Fantastic concert, and that just kind of gets us set up for the actual show on September 22nd. But to mix a live performance, what's the difference there? How do you approach that compared to mixing a studio record?
It's basically the same premise. Sometimes, like, you're trying to get as much of the crowd in there as you can.
Yeah.
You know, there's obviously a lot of PA in the mics as well. So, you know, there's a lot of things you got to watch out for, you know, any sort of amp squeals, and, you know, there's problems that you sort of have to overcome that you want to retain the liveness, and you want to go through and edit and fix things out. But, you know, sometimes you've got to get rid of that squelch that all of a sudden rips everybody's eardrums. Because live, you don't care. Your ears are already numb because of the sheer volume. But when you're watching a DVD in your home, it's like, oh, what was that? Oh, that hurt, you know. So you try and kind of control madness is basically how I look at it, you know.
Where are you going to be at DC Place? Right up front or in the wings? Or where is Mike Fraser at the AC/DC show?
I'm going to be riding Angus's back. He's got the best seat in the deck.
There you go. Mike Fraser, it was a pleasure talking to you, sir. Congratulations on all your success and hard work. Well-deserved. And maybe we'll see you at the AC/DC show, DC Place, September 22nd.
Oh, thank you, Michelle. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks, man.
You've been listening to an episode of Unedited with Vancouver Sun Arts and Entertainment editor and reporter Francois Marchand. Follow Francois on Twitter at FMarchandVS or read his blog on VancouverSun.com.